Hello and welcome to the Liberation Podcast, an exploration of what it means when we say our liberation is bound in each other. Through interviews and personal dialogue, we will dissect just how liberation is experienced by the individual and how in result manifests in their communities. Let's get started. Hello and welcome to the Liberation Podcast. I am Svara Parrott, your host. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening today. I'm just going to get right into it. All right, we're just going to dive right in because this is going to be maybe not a heavy hitter because that might be a little ooky spooky and induce a little anxiety. But today's a serious conversation between myself and someone who I've admired their work for a long time. And so we kind of just dive head into it. So might as well do that in the intro as well. So today I am joined with author and podcast host Patrick Farnsworth. Like I said, I've been a fan and follower of Patrick's work with his podcast, Last Born in the Wilderness, for about 3 years now, 3.5 years, depending. And he really has, to me, a profound way of executing and articulating some really difficult and challenging things that has helped me kind of deconstruct and begin a journey of really tearing down some notions and some just disinformation that I've carried for a long time about the U.S., about global politics, about ecological disaster and ecological political situations. And so a little bit more information about Patrick. Like I said, he is an author and podcast host. His podcast called Last Born in the Wilderness. I would describe his podcast and borrowing some language from his website, but it is a long-form interview-based podcast that functions under the philosophy of anti-fascism, anti-racism, anti-capitalism, and ecologically centered information. And he goes into this further into the episode about how he uses ecological destruction and environmental issues as a kind of paramount intersection between all systems of oppression and kind of the future outlook and future motivation for humankind, as a way to say it. He is also an author. He wrote a book that is a collection of his some former interviews done on his podcast with also different personal analysis and outlook on those interviews and how they portray to the current times of him writing it. And that is called We Live in the Orbit of Beings Greater Than Us. It is through Gods and Radicals Press that is published. And he also does a few other writing excerpts that have been published on the interwebs and has done a TEDx talk. He is a well-published and well-regarded, I would say, truth teller, or at least in the context of this podcast, a space maker for truth telling and for people to voice their professional opinions. And also, in many ways, share vulnerable and specific experiences of healing, different emotional states in context to different system oppression. So that is why I invited Patrick to be on this show, because I myself have experienced some pretty profound connections to the people that have been on his show, different elements of himself showing vulnerability within his, you know, almost 5-year project of Last Born in the Wilderness. And so for this episode, I wanted to provide you all as listeners an introduction into his work and his ability to not only speak about the hopelessness of a lot of the systems that surround us, or sometimes all, but to also provide a space of empathy and interpersonal wellness and healing. There are many ways to approach the reality in which we live in and the act of collapse is that we live in our daily lives. And I believe that Patrick has a specific determination of connection and value in his work. And I really hope that that comes across in our conversation. Support for this podcast can be done in a multitude of ways. I have a Patreon set up that you can find in the link in the description of the show. There are different tiers that involve heads up on future guests, abilities to ask the guests specific questions if you'd like, different Discord and discourse that's allowed on the Patreon. So take a look if you are able to financially support the show. There's also one-time donations through Venmo or PayPal. All of that is in the show descriptions. Also, ways to connect with Patrick on his website and through his Patreon as well for his work is available there. Follow, rate, and subscribe to the show. That means a lot and allows for people that possibly would not have seen this show because of some overlord algorithmic nonsense. So people engaging in those kind of small ways actually help in a big impactful way for myself, and I'm able to gauge my connection with you all as well. I really cannot suggest Patrick's podcast more. It's one of the first things that I recommend to people when they're asking me a bunch of questions about different systems that they are trying to deconstruct or different current events that they're trying to make sense of. I think that Patrick's work is an incredible way to democratize and also humanize a lot of the different systems that exist there, or show the human impact that are in those systems. And so, yeah, please listen to his work. It's incredible. And buy his book if you are able to, or support his Patreon, all of those things. All right. This is my conversation with Patrick Farnsworth. Cool. So Patrick, I've been a fan of your work and have been listening to your podcast for, I would say now, like 3.5 years, I guess. It's been quite a long time. Wow. And my first recommendation to anyone who is trying to get into kind of deconstructing their ideas or trying to make sense of a lot of stuff that's going on. It's definitely one of the, if not the first, like, podcast I'll recommend people listen to, because I think you have a really great way of democratizing that information, and people have it, and the people that you bring on, while it is pretty unceasing, intense topics, like, that's kind of an unavoidable thing.
Yeah.
I think they all, in a way, in their own ways and their expertise, provides such a foundational, like, both a foundational understanding, but also a future direction of what these systems are, could do or are doing, or what their work is attempting to do, etc. Mm-hmm. So just for people that are listening to this and are unaware of your work or who you are, if you could take us through your journey of starting this work, because I know you've come from a complex understanding or a complex background. And so what were these kind of gears that put you in place to not only deconstruct your own understanding of things, but also start this kind of work?
Yeah. Well, and I think I officially started the podcast as it is called today, Last Born in the Wilderness. I think I'm losing track of time, but I think it was about 8 years ago, maybe, which is, you know, kind of wild. But I think I actually started the work I'm doing now, the work that you're familiar with, about 4 years ago or so. So, you know, I didn't really know what I was doing with the work for half the time that I've officially had this podcast. But yeah, I mean, in the notes that you sent before the interview began, you know, you mentioned kind of my religious upbringing, and how did that translate into starting a podcast that discusses all of these different subjects, has this sort of almost an intense focus on things that are, like, I've had, you know, listeners, you know, supporters of my work who are like, I just need to take a break. Like, I can't, I listen to an episode and I'm like, I just got to step away for a few weeks or a few months. And I totally respect that. And I understand that. And I have to do that too. But yeah, I mean, I guess I started this, I think I've always had this inner dialogue, this constant thing where I'm always working out ideas through almost like talking to myself constantly, whether I'm vocalizing it or not. And I'm always very curious about a lot of different subjects. And I always wanted to know why things were the way they were. And I don't think that's unique. But, you know, I grew up in a very conservative, I say very conservative, but that's depends on what you mean by that. But I grew up in a religious environment in rural Idaho. And I grew up LDS as well, Mormon. So, and not only that, but I grew up with a father whom I love, but at the time when I was growing up was very fixated on the apocalypse and fixated on the end of days, almost the way that a lot of evangelical Christians tend to be as well. And LDS people are interested in the apocalypse, but my father had this really esoteric interpretation of the LDS church doctrine. And, you know, so I was raised with the belief that we were reaching the end of days, that Christ was going to come back any, you know, within the next several years. Mm-hmm. Like, I would say probably by now, Christ should have returned at this point, you know.
Maybe a couple of times, I think, at this point.
Yeah, right. Yeah, he should have already come back. But I think there was something, and I remember at an interview once with somebody, we talked about this, because I think we were discussing just cultic thinking, and I think we were actually, interestingly, talking about QAnon, but how there's this intersection between evangelical Christianity and QAnon, and why QAnon works so well with that, without getting into the details of that particular conspiracy theory cult. I think it wires your brain a certain way. I think that there's they call it like a religious trauma almost that you experience. And so anyway, I grew up in that environment, and there was just a lot for me to unpack, you know? And I would say in my early 20s, what happened was I had already moved away from the church and I wasn't interested in being religious at all. I had several, you know, curious thoughts and questions that were not satisfactorily answered by those in the church. I mean, just to say this briefly, the LDS church is a very patriarchal and obviously sexist religion, and founded on the values of American or U.S. American colonialism. And there's also racism built into that too. So I was asking these questions. They didn't make any sense. It didn't seem correct. So I left, and then after a certain point, I became more political. I guess I just became curious about politics. At that point, when I was young, I was probably 12 or 13, when 9/11 happened, the war in Afghanistan and Iraq was beginning. I started reading at some point, like, Noam Chomsky somehow came across.
A classic 13-year-old read.
Yeah, right. I think I was like 16 when I read some of his books, and I was like, oh my God, like, really blew my head open as far as what the U.S. empire was, and started to understand capitalism, how that operated. Of course, began to really question a lot of these subjects and dig into them. And then at a certain point in my early 20s, I started to become more interested in the environmental question, the issues around ecological crisis, and specifically around climate disruption. And once I really began to understand that information, it sort of threw me into a bit of an existential crisis, to say the very least. I mean, that was probably a time of severe depression and suicidal ideation, and just not really a very healthy or good place. I think out of all of that, somehow the podcast became a way for me to generate my own meaning as a way to connect dots, to reach out to other people and talk to them, people that I was very intellectually curious in, but also, as I learned over time, it became more emotionally and even spiritually nourishing, because it wasn't just about the interviews. It was also these people that were craving these types of conversations. And so I've met incredible human beings along the way, and my work has just evolved in almost a unpredictable, organic fashion since then. I don't know if that really answers the question adequately, but I don't know how, or, you know, it's curious what leads you down the paths that you end up going down in your life. But for me, doing the podcast is a way for me to express a creative it's a creative outlet for me. I can do a lot with it, and it's been very good for me.
You know, when you're talking about LDS, I have a few, grew up with a few friends in LDS. Also, my adoptive father, I think at some point had a stint in the LDS church in Washington. But, you know, there, and I grew up around a lot of evangelical Christians, and just a very intense pseudo evangelical, because they were non-denominational, which is code for a lot. Something about that apocalyptic teaching is, I guess there's two things with it. One, it forces anybody to be in a cycle of fear a lot, and not just fear of like fucking up and not being able to go to heaven or something, but also like very real fear in their life and their daily actions and how they function. And that also places you, but they also perpetuate a state of anxiety, because they're, if you were to question your own fear or try to deconstruct fear, you are then going against this leadership or this, you know, church of worship or house of worship. And, you also will go to hell for that. So like, it's interesting if, that some sects of religion, and that's not limited to Christianity either. There's plenty of apocalyptic cultural beliefs or not cultural, religious beliefs that exist, but it makes it a system that's really difficult to deconstruct. And, it very much is that kind of your own kind of spiritual relinquishing to be able to begin that process of finding some other purpose or finding a different drive that isn't derived in fear, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I think growing up in that environment is emotionally and even cognitively stunting individuals that grow up. And it kind of sets you back in a lot of ways from being able to deal with the complexity of the world. I think it's easier for people to have this sort of, and this sounds reductive, and I actually, as people that interpret religion in a far more nuanced and complex and even more compassionate way, but I feel like I've definitely come across people who, you know, would rather believe something that it provides a sense of comfort, but it's debilitating. And that's what I felt like was happening. You know, you feel like you reach a point where you're not growing anymore. And it relies on fear. It's a fear-based thing. And there's this in-group, out-group thing that happens, you know, once you've... And I've experienced this in multiple ways, too, not just with religion. I've even experienced it in the workplace, you know, in certain work environments where once you're out, you're out. Once, you know, when you're in. There's this sort of dynamic that's really perplexing and very... It's disturbing once you kind of feel it. And
I think you can see that in different areas, even in like, I'm going to say like the left in like a capital L, like the left, progressive thinking, where there are certain organizers or certain people that hold the belief that there is no space for disagreements, or there's no space to really just put each other in a state of questioning or whatever, of making sure that the actions that we are trying to align with are ones that are actually going to benefit this cause or benefit us as spiritual animal beings. And there are, because I've experienced this as well, as of being okay, you're going to step away from this movement or this planning group or whatever, and then we're not going to invite you back into that space, or you do not belong in this specific space.
Yeah. There's definitely these orthodoxies that exist, and, it becomes a box, becomes something that once you step outside of it, they don't want you back in there. And, that's actually really devastating, especially when it gets into, I know we're talking about the left, but I think, there's people that I've known that, speaking within the religious context, once they question and they begin to step outside of the religion that they grew up within, they're leaving behind an entire community of people. They're leaving behind their families even. And and it's not by choice. It's not like they want to leave their families behind. Their families abandoned them. And there was actually, I had a barista job once, and I've had several of them, but one of them in particular, it was a pretty big building, and they had an upstairs area that you could rent out for events and meetings and stuff. And there was one group that would meet there about once a month, and it was, I can't remember the name of it, but it was an ex-Mormon support group. And these were people that were like in their middle age. I mean, they were like, I had families, they had children, and they would gather and they would just talk about what it was that got them questioning it even at that late stage in their life. I mean, it's pretty remarkable what it is and what particular series of events and questions that come up that lead people down that path. But to see people in their 40s trying coffee for the first time or beer. It's interesting. And I'm like, in my late 20s or early 30s, like giving them their first beer and they're like 45 years old.
Yeah.
Not that like alcohol has to be that thing, but you know what I mean? Like there's just this, there's limitations that are imposed on them of what they should or shouldn't do. And they're starting to explore certain aspects of life that they just have never been able to explore before. They were afraid to. They were felt it was wrong. It was sinful. That it was somehow impact their eternal life. You know, it's pretty wild to see that.
There's a kind of, I guess there's an opportunity for a lot of beauty in those experiences for them as well, or even to share that experience with them, even for a brief transaction. It kind of reminds me a little bit of, I am a fellow barista, and, when things started opening up a little bit, granted, I wasn't psyched about it, but I think the fun, the interactions that I was having with people is a lot of people just forgot how to talk to other human beings. But I found that incredibly beautiful, because when you're home, you're locked in your home alone, and maybe some people were with families, some people were fully by themselves. I had one of my I was living with somebody at the time, and you develop your own experiences and language with this person or with yourself or whatever, and then and society has basically no rules at that point, like, because you're just by yourself, it's very insular, and then you have to come face to face with a human being, and then you forget everything. Yeah. And that's a really beautiful thing. I think I'm going to pivot a little bit. Yeah. So went the little COVID tangent.
Yeah.
So you had mentioned, in your like timeline of getting into, at least the podcast and your kind of experience getting into this kind of deconstructive mode, that climate change and climate collapse was a major pivoting topic for you. And I'm wondering, like, why is that so? But also, like, for you, but also, do you feel that the topic and the active subject, because it's happening. It continues to happen, climate collapse. Do you feel that this is, it's a very necessary or maybe like the penultimate thing that is happening that kind of allows for you to deconstruct other systems that exist? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Because I think...
Not so to say that climate change is the most important thing in the world. I mean, like, do you know what I mean? It's not all, they're not on hierarchical ratings.
Yeah, right. Yeah, there's levels to it. But also there's something to be said about the climate crisis. We call it a crisis, but the climate's, the human-caused or the capitalist systems caused climate disruption that is occurring, it overshadows, first of all, it's situated within the broader ecological crisis, so that needs to be stated. Because even if we were able to somehow pull all the heat out of the atmosphere and the oceans, and we were to just somehow, you know, bring everything down to a decent temperature again, magical thinking, but let's just say that was possible. We're still dealing with massive destruction of our ecologies, of the various bioregions around the world. So that in of itself could lead to human, you know, like societal collapse and, you know, really difficult subjects to really kind of psychologically, emotionally, spiritually deal with. Yeah. But for me, this question around the nature of climate change and the ecological crisis, it does overshadow, I have to say, every other thing that I am interested in talking about on the podcast. It does situate everything within a broader context, because it's like, well, what does it mean to talk about any of the things that are happening right now, whether we're talking like today, I mentioned I did an interview earlier today. We talked about the my view of the Republican Party basically becoming a fascist party in the United States, and the implications of seeing this sort of white nationalism rising in the United States, and how does that situate within this climate crisis? How does, you know, talking about indigeneity or indigenous struggles and decolonization, addressing the legacy of colonialism, white supremacy, and all these other subjects, how does that fit within this much larger thing? Not to say that those aren't connected, but this very large thing that is occurring right now that we can't stop. And I can't help but think about that all the time. And it's actually a constant on an individual level. I mean, it's sometimes I just have to stop because I don't know what to do. You know, and I don't ever want to put it on a hierarchy and ever want to say that any of these other subjects aren't as important. And honestly, they're all interrelated. And actually, part of talking about these things on the podcast has been a way for me to find those common threads, right? And I've wanted to really make sense of that through the work. But yeah, so climate. So okay, so this big thing is happening. The climate is changing radically. We're currently experiencing it happening at an increasingly rapid rate through extreme weather events, through droughts, through disruptions in the supply chain, even the rise of COVID and other you know, pandemics is a symptom of the ecological crisis. All of these subjects, when you really just, I guess you just step back and you just look at it and you're like, it all feels inevitable. And there's this almost fatalistic, tragic quality to everything. Sorry, I think I got off track a little bit because it's just a little overwhelming when I do think about it. It's about learning how to grieve, which I don't know how to do fully. It's about talking to people that, in whatever ways that they have through their work, are not only truthfully explaining what's happening, but also exploring with me, at least in the work that they do in a general sense, how to build the capacity to hold grief. And in a sense, I don't even know if it's possible to hold. I don't think we can hold all of the grief
mm-hmm.
of everything that is happening and that is being lost mm-hmm. right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, the climate crisis really punctuates every single thing that I'm trying to explore on the podcast, because the overarching theme of it is like, well, how do we be in this time? How do we live with honesty and truth mm-hmm. and have, you know, a sense of justice and
mm-hmm.
Pursue beauty and love in a time where everything feels almost the opposite of all of those things, mm-hmm. where it feels ugly and it feels constraining and it's anxiety inducing. And we have systems that are not bent towards justice at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't seem like there's any way out. And so, I don't know what I'm trying to say here, mm-hmm. except that I wrestle with this a lot.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And thank you for that honesty and that, reflection of the kind of anxiety and overwhelmness that comes up when thinking about it. And I think a lot of people share that experience a lot of just almost losing, not losing words, but losing kind of a linear narrative in that. But I think a way to maybe contextualize it for some people who are listening. So I think for the way that I view climate change being this kind of penultimate intersection of systems is like the first thing you can think of, the farming system or just food in general, especially in the States, but really you can look at any country that has been colonized. You can look at any of them, and realize, food systems that are set up, politically to either redline areas where people are within food deserts. You have a food desert, and so people are not able to access and or have a harder time to gain monetary funds to mm-hmm. access more food. Mm-hmm. That puts people in a state of poverty and or in a state of food shortage, which is usually also placed in a line of racism. Mm-hmm. And this creates that is the end goal, is to create a system of poverty perpetuate a system of inadequate sustainability. That's one example. You can also look at tourism, like in Hawaii, where it's tourism excludes indigeneity. People are kicked off of their own land. Mm-hmm. They are then criminalized. Their religions and spiritual practices are criminalized. They are put into the smallest brinks or the furthest edges of their own country and their own land. And then they are imprisoned for trying to reclaim that land or reclaim any kind of identity in that. And that's all land, which is all environmental. And at the same time, they're also killing off indigenous plants, indigenous wildlife, all of these things. So it's like, for anyone listening, there is a true intersectionality between just about any system. Talk about the fucking ocean, where it's fossil fuel representatives were the highest accounted for delegates in the fucking climate change summit in Paris. What are they doing there? Oh, because the U.S. just sold a shitload of mileages off the Gulf Coast for oil drilling, even though they are the president promised to not do any of that in the beginning of his administration. So it's this whole thing where it bleeds into every aspect of land, food, wildlife, and mm-hmm. sustainability, all of it. Sorry for that tangent. That is just how tangibly how that works. So
it's all connected, and you were mentioning and just in saying all of that has to do with indigenous sovereignty over their own mm-hmm. ancestral I mean, what lands that they've had. Mm-hmm. Like, you talked about the Hawaiian people, of course. Mm-hmm. They've, the colonization of that island, it was originally colonized by U.S. businessmen.
Right.
Like, speaking to, like, the legacy of colonialism, right, and the rise of capitalism.
Right.
Those are all connected. And then their lack of access to maybe the food systems that they traditionally have had for so long that, mm-hmm, they've had, you know, sustainably for hundreds or thousands of years, you know, mm-hmm, like, all of these things are deeply interrelated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you talk about oil drilling. I mean, it's amazing that a president can speak about the emergency of climate change and yet still be giving away, essentially, I mean, it's auctioning off, but essentially giving away coastline to be drilled for oil production. So it's like, what faith can we possibly have in, right, this system, mm-hmm, to adequately deal with a crisis of this magnitude? And it can't, right, and it won't, and it'll continue to produce this, it'll continue to go down the path that has been going down for hundreds of years. And certainly there's a path of resistance there. There, mm-hmm, are people that resist, and I want to be clear, like, I you know, whatever happens, but there's always been people,
mm-hmm,
that have put their bodies on the line, that, mm-hmm, have attempted, and sometimes, mm-hmm, successfully, mm-hmm, attempted to stop this Leviathan from destroying everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always good, mm-hmm, and that it always should be done. I guess for me, I'll just say this. I think one of the things I've said in the past is, like, you do things not because you're going to, you perceive a particular outcome.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't do a thing just because you expect it. You don't do the right thing because you expect to win or to guarantee a certain outcome. You know, you hope for it,
mm-hmm,
but you don't know if it's ever going to happen. You, mm-hmm, do it because it's the right thing to do. If you love the earth and you love the land and you love the people,
right,
then you're going to fight for it. And that's the point, you know, right, and even if it's ultimately going to fail,
mm,
you know.
And yeah, there's, you know, I talk about this specifically a lot, of how unbelievably resilient and just genuinely badass people have been for hundreds and hundreds of years of, yeah, uprisings against any kind of oppression.
Yeah.
And something that, like, truly is agonizing in my brain is how hard systems of oppression and leaders within those systems try to disinform and make sure that no one understands or is educated in that history. And but there's so much triumph and so much just, like, I don't know, it's just awe-inspiring when you hear specific,
oh yeah,
stories, or like, I was just listening to Working Class History, and then they were, I was just listening to a series about uprisings in South Korea during, mm, just post the Korean War, and just how unbelievably resilient these small villages are, fully overtaking a Korean government or a Korean police within their own village and just being able to hold them off for days on end.
Yeah.
And that's incredible. That's fucking incredible.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or something that irritates me so much is even thinking in the States of, like, of the abolition of slavery and how we're taught that it was a white man who did that.
Yeah.
And paints this absurd picture that Black people were so helpless for 250 years and, yeah, did just no uprisings. You know, they didn't even help write any kind of legislation about abolition. They did nothing. They just waited for someone to save them, which is insane to me.
Yeah.
And I don't fully know why I got on this tangent. Oh, well, you were talking about the lineage, yeah, of people fighting about that. And it's just, God, I encourage people so much to just connect with that lineage of resilience and uprising, because it, even if you do not find yourself, you know, boots to the ground or whatever, I think it helps in the minute ways that you can find help in accepting a lot of these things, is that human beings, conscious human beings that know that there is a better truth outside of like oppressive systems.
Yeah.
Want to triumph over those things.
Yeah. Yeah. I think what the, a colonized mindset produces is disconnection and dissociation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even like, I was just thinking of some of these animist, counselors and practitioners that I've gotten to know and have mm-hmm. interviewed. They even talk about, like, you know, the colonized body mm-hmm. is disconnected from their own body. Mm-hmm. We're and I'm speaking for myself. Mm-hmm. I feel like my body is colonized, most definitely. Mm-hmm. Disconnected from your hips, disconnected from your lower half of your body, which is connected to the earth. Dude. I mean, something as fundamental as your body
mm-hmm.
is, you're dissociated from it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's what happens on every level of what it is to be, to exist within a system. You know, we're dissociated mm. from how food is produced and where it comes from. We're dissociated sure. from the ecologies that we rely upon for our own existence. And we're dissociated from the levels of violence and of normalized, invisibilized violence that's required and maintained
mm-hmm.
in order to do anything in this yeah. system. And I think that that's what it wants. I think it wants you to become dissociated from what it is to be, to exist, to keep, to have this system function. I think if we were to become fully aware of that on mm. some deep fundamental level, we wouldn't accept it. But there's all kinds of ways in which we're distracted away from it. And also we're coerced,
yeah,
you know, to participate in it on a great way. And so I think what happens is when, you know, when you look at the dawn of the industrial capitalist system, or you can look to when the first conquistadors and the so-called conquerors came to the North American, South American continents, the islands of this great place, you know, people could see pretty clearly what these people were and mm. what they were going to do and how. You know, I mean, they may have greeted them with kindness at first, but it became very clear that they weren't there to be their friends.
Right.
Of course, we know this. And so once that became apparent, they fought, you know, as hard as they could. And I'm overgeneralizing, and I don't want to throw everything in one big yeah. overgeneralization. But, you know, on a wide scale, people resisted it every step of the way, even all the way back in Europe where, you know, these colonial empires emerged.
Mm-hmm.
The people of Europe had to be colonized first before that could spread outwards to other continents. So
totally.
I think every step of the way, if you really dig into the research, if you really want to learn, then you find, yeah, people have always fought back. And like you said, this narrative or story that, you know, enslaved peoples were liberated by Abraham Lincoln or mm-hmm. some form of legislation or a war, which again, those are components, but that most definitely wasn't what was happening. Infantilizes black people.
Yeah. Oh,
you
yes.
know, like,
yes.
oh, they couldn't understand yes. freedom until we taught them.
And I'm
like,
yes.
No, that has never been the case ever.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, one of the most first successful revolution of the, I think anyway, of the 19th century was the Haitian Revolution.
Yeah.
And those were all enslaved people on an island.
Yes.
And they were like, fuck this, we're overthrowing this right now.
It is an incredible revolution.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what? And it's horrible, but the you know, the consequences of that, of course, mm-hmm. what they did was amazing, but the consequences of that is when the empire mm-hmm. reacted against that, it was to crush them under their boot for hundreds
yeah.
of years.
That we and still so, see effects of to this
yeah,
day. 100%.
Absolutely. Again, that's not meant to instill like despair or like that we yeah. should give into it. It's mm. just the brutality of the system is very naked for everyone to see. And yeah. So it has to create narratives and lies and mythologies and all kinds of things to dissociate us from that, right. that legacy of oppression and violence.
Yeah.
And I think actually I'll just say this, I just tie this into something contemporarily, mm-hmm. the sort of anti-critical race theory shit is,
sure.
in my opinion, a part of that trend of,
yeah. 100%. Like,
we can't let people really know our history. Because people will feel shame, as they rightfully should.
And okay, so to move, I could talk about that specific subject of just disinformation for another hour. Mm-hmm. But I want to talk about, because you were mentioning, you already kind of foreshadowed this a bit, about talking about healing and especially like somatic healing and decolonizing the body, essentially. I feel that because I've been listening for a long time now, I feel that there, you reached a certain point in the in your show and in your work where a certain, I don't want to say that it flipped a switch, because I don't think that it was ever lacking a certain kind of like empathy or introspection on your like a more vulnerability towards your inwardness of your own experiences in these things. But I feel yeah. that around episode like 200, 250, it started to get discussion of healing and love and that kind of healing in your body started to arise. And then there's a phenomenal conversation with some somatic healers back in like last year. And
yeah.
in a great conversation with Dare So High, which I think I've listened to like 5 times now, because it's just phenomenal. But
yeah,
how has that growth and that kind of evolution manifested for you? And with no pressure of speaking too personally, you don't have to, but, cause that is a deeply personal thing. But I just happen to know, as someone who, takes in the content that you make, there has been a very noticeable difference, at least to me, in the kind of vulnerability that you reach with yourself and with different guests and such when you are speaking on those topics.
Yeah. I think especially like that interview with Dare brought out something I wasn't expecting.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I definitely prepare for my interviews, of course, sure. right? I research them. Right, points and questions I would like to get to. But people are full of surprises, and someone like Dare and some others as well, but they, I can think of a few different people that just like challenged me.
Yeah.
And I think it's pretty visible, or you can hear it, you know, yeah, in the audio.
Absolutely.
You can be like, oh shit, okay, yeah. here I am. I have to be real now, be present.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I think what happens is certain things happen in my personal life that I have to work out, and I've joked about this, but it's not completely a joke, but I will use the podcast as a way to seek conversations that I feel will be needed for me.
Oh, totally.
And what happens in that work, as well as others hear that, and that also provides a similar thing for them too. So they listen and they're like, I'm kind of on that journey as well.
Totally.
And I've been, say, validated, but I've heard very encouraging things from listeners. They're like, that really hit me where I needed to hit.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize I even needed it, but I got it, you know? I don't know what happened. I think last year, especially, because last year was a fucking ride. I mean, we're almost to the end of 2021, Dad. But it doesn't really even feel like we
My
even had 2021.
Fucking God, yeah.
You know, there's all these memes and jokes,
you know,
I see
on the internet. We started this year with an insurrection, and then it
yeah.
kept getting worse.
Right. Exactly.
Me
like
too.
There was yeah, like, you mean it, yeah, pandemic, and then uprisings, and
yeah.
and then of course everything culminated with Trump, and I mean in the United States specifically, it felt
yeah.
very intense, and there's a lot of reasons for that.
Mm.
So I was using the podcast as a tool to make sense of what I was seeing throughout the year. And I'm like, my body, like I feel something in my body and I don't understand it and I don't know what it is. So I've been told this, and people mean it in a sweet way, but they're like, you can you intellectualize everything. You want to talk about it, and, you know, and I'm like, it's good for podcasting, but, like, you know, what do I do when the real feelings come up?
Yeah.
You know? So, you know, the somatic stuff really came up because I became, throughout the podcast, I was more aware of animism and this idea mm-hmm. that our bodies are not just our bodies. Everything is a part of our body.
Mm-hmm.
So naturally we're feeling, experiencing things on these somatic levels. And I really wanted to just talk to people to understand that, because once that clicked, it was like, okay, now what does somatic healing actually mean? And and I guess I was also a bit resistant, because what happens is there's like two sides. There's the side of it where I'm like appropriately wary of woo-woo bullshit, which wants to like sell kind of like this hippie crystal, like, you know, whatever. Like if you're into that, like, okay. But there is this sort of commodified spirituality when that's very real, totally. Right? Absolutely, right? But then there's people that are actually doing like real fucking work.
Yeah.
And they're doing something. And like when I came across Dare Sohei or Tada Hazumi or a few other people.
That was a great conversation.
Yeah, I'm like, wow, you're actually touching on things that I don't really even understand. I think I should probably talk to you to make sense of this.
Yeah.
And, you know, those conversations were challenging, and I knew that it would produce a conversation that I think would benefit other people as well, because I'm distinctly aware that I'm not alone mm-hmm. in this disconnection from my body. And how, like, I've had numerous conversations with another friend of mine who, you know, talks about how it's so difficult to like be present and aware of the onslaught of bad news that's coming in all the time. And like, mm-hmm. how do you regulate yourself? How do you live your life under these sort of mm-hmm. conditions, you know? And that's when I started really, I just started becoming aware of like, mm-hmm. this is affecting me on a body level.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the switch happened, because there was something very personal happening mm-hmm. with me. And again, I tend to process a lot of these things through the podcast. And
I think I would love to know anyone who independently runs a podcast, because Lord knows the landscape of podcasting has changed a shit ton in the last 2 years of a lot of corporate sponsored podcasting.
Yeah.
Which is never that great, but I won't say that, but the landscape is different. But I, in a very similar way of when you have that kind of switch and using the podcast as a way to maybe not guide thoughts, but find thoughts and maybe contextualize what your body is needing, or what it's curious about. I kind of did the same when launching this show too. I spent, the better half of that initial lockdown, almost like coming to term. I think it was the best way to describe is finally emotionally, or allowing my emotions of decolonization to reach where I logically understood it. And like you were saying, I also have a hilariously great habit of, over intellectualizing a lot. And, I think I didn't know what to do with myself, but I knew that I needed to, say something out loud. Some may argue might be a little narcissistic to start a podcast about it, but I'm just trying to figure out what the fuck is going on in your brain. But, I think, and I think it makes sense for the topics that respectively we both talk about to talk to people that help guide these different emotions that are going on. 'Cause I think there's no tools for anyone to really figure out how to talk about it, and connect it to have it democratized enough to understand it logically, but also empathetic enough to where you can feel it and be present with how it makes you feel, as opposed to just keeping it in your brain,
which is difficult. Yeah, I mean, that's how I've thought of the podcast as one is, like your term, democratizing it, because I don't know if that's the appropriate word, if that's the appropriate word for what I'm about to say, but the sense of, I never want to like not share what I'm making with everybody.
Yeah.
I have a few things I do for like my Patreon, if you're a supporter or whatever, but like generally speaking, every interview I do, I release it. And I do that just because, and everyone can do it however they want. This is a judgment on how people conduct that side of their work. But too often I hear that from listeners that this interview really helps them. And I would think, well, what would that be like if they couldn't have access to that because I was trying to make money or something? You know, I fall on that end of it where I really like to share what I'm making and make it as widely available as possible. And I also recognize that, I'm not the subject of the interviews, obviously, but it's kind of like a movie where the character that you're identifying with is able to help you like enter the film in a certain kind of way.
Totally.
Like for you right now, you're you're like, people are identifying with you on a certain level.
Right.
And they're listening to me and they feel like they're like connecting because you're connecting.
Right.
And that's my understanding of at least of how people have interpreted my work.
100%.
And, so yeah.
Yeah. And that, I think there's a, I don't remember who you were speaking to. It might have been Tada. I don't remember you talking about somatic healing, or I think the whole a crux of the conversation was about somatic healing isn't just for a certain ethnic group or a certain race of people or whatever. It is for anyone who experiences, well, really, you don't even have to experience trauma unless somatic healing can also just be used to be greater connected to an environment or a lineage that exists there. But I think it's really important to note, because this was the first time I had ever heard about, you know, white people coming to white, specifically US people I can speak about, can't really speak about the rest. Coming to terms with ancestry and having to also heal from that. And, I mean, Toni Morrison said it in a very seminal interview of just that, like, racism affects you too. Slavery affected you too. And all of these systems of oppression that you may or may not have privilege from also affect you and create dissociation from your body. And obviously, I can't put myself in your shoes, but I feel like that is a really a complex thing to understand for somebody like in their body of like, okay, how do I not dissociate from privilege, because you can't do that, but like, how do I heal parts of a lineage that we're taught to dissociate from it, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I think privilege produces blindness ultimately. So there's things that I would never see or notice unless it was like really like intentionally placed in front of me. Like I'll speak to this real quick, which is I'll see how much I want to talk about it. I went to Brazil for 2 months. It was about 2 years ago, and that experience fucked me up in a lot of ways, because I not only am I white and a male from the global north, I'm going down to the global south. I'm going to Brazil. And there were things that were things that I saw and experienced that really, truly highlighted layers of privilege and blindness that I had in it. I dissociated a lot while I was there. I had a lot of dissociation because I was having an intense experience, and it was like sensory overload. And yet at the same time I was there, I was I was learning, you know, like a, I don't want to compare it to a psychedelic experience. I'll just say it's like a really intense experience where a lot of information is coming into your system,
yeah,
and you can't process it quickly.
Yeah.
And that's what privilege, I think, is. And that's why white people and privileged people react so angrily when they're being shown something that their body seemingly or their consciousness is unable to really make sense of and process. And they act like fucking lunatics as a result. And it could happen all kinds of ways. And some people, they do the whole, like, I'm guilty, I'm fawning, can you please show me that you approve of me finally? I'm so sorry for what I did. And they want to do the groveling. People are going to go, maybe go through that. Maybe that's part of the process. I don't know. Either way, I think we saw a lot of that. We still see a lot of that among privileged white people. White people, because they really want to feel like they're absolved of a sin. And and it doesn't work that way. No one's going to forgive you for this. It's not about being forgiven. It's about living completely differently than what you've been, what you've inherited. And there's not an easy answer to that. But it's something that has to be very deeply interrogated and constantly questioned. And you're probably going to bump up against it repeatedly and feel uncomfortable for the rest of your life. And there's no, like, be better. See things better. Articulate it if you can. Do anti-racist work, whatever that is to you and the place you're in. All of that is important. Not to say that those aren't a part of it, but you know, there's no one's going to be sitting here and applauding your efforts,
right? But and also, what do your efforts mean if you aren't also getting in touch with a lineage that was just a lineage of privilege? And also, like, without being, if you were to do, you know, do the work without having this, and at least even an attempt to connect where the fuck that stuff is stored in your body, where for however long, you are going to be in a perpetual cycle of tripping over your own privilege, fawning and asking for your forgiveness or trying to do better, and then almost like a keloid that, like, wraps itself around a wound. Like, it's, you're just gonna rip open a wound over and over and over again.
That's true.
Even though that wound is never going to be maybe fully healed, there are ways to mend a wound that can prevent it from being ripped open over and over and over again.
Yeah, you were pointing to that in your original kind of question or statement before I went on my little rant there.
That's okay.
But no, yeah, that's exactly it. So, you know, maybe to circle this, maybe ties into what we talked about earlier with my religious upbringing or you know, how the podcast kind of came out of that. You know, what does it mean for a group, my ancestors came here in the late 1800s to come here, and they are settlers. I mean, they came here from Europe. They settled in what is now called Utah and Idaho. They converted to a religion that was founded by a man who described himself as being a prophet. They believed in that somehow, and that somehow compelled them to cross an entire ocean and travel across most of a continent to settle somewhere. And I'm like, I have these questions, like, how the hell did that happen? And why did that happen? What were the historical contexts of that entire, and that happened to millions of people. And, you know, what kind of ghosts does that produce in the land and in the bodies of those that that descend from that? You know, what's lingering with me now? And what do I have to ask? And what do I have to do to see, I have to just see those ghosts and acknowledge them for what they are, and then go from there, you know? And there's not, there's no playbook here. There's no, as far as I know, you know, there's no, like, easy, like, you know, bullet point, you know, guide.
You ever heard the book White Fragility? That might be the playbook.
Oh God. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Oh God. Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, this is the double edge of privilege, the dual, I don't know if they had the right way to say that, but yeah, there's absolutely privileges and there's a material wealth that comes with that.
Mm-hmm.
But we're spiritually impoverished.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why I think I started, you know, this is maybe the trajectory of the podcast on a certain level. It's this sort of meta thinking, climate mm-hmm. disruption, this big global thing that's happening. It's really mm-hmm. big and it's going to impact all human civilization.
Mm-hmm.
And then over time, it's just like gotten to this level of like, I'm disconnected from my own body. And totally. That has produced a global crisis of such magnitude
totally.
That is not even to be barely comprehended.
Yeah.
That's a trip.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, the trajectory of what I've done. And I think so many others have done as well. I'm definitely not alone in this.
Right.
Yeah. It's like, it goes deep into the body and into the soul.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you did a fucking monster of a job of wrapping up the last 100 episodes of your podcast into a 7-part series that I listened to all of. And it took me a really impressive long time, brother. It took a long time.
I know.
Probably not even close to the fraction of time it took for you to do it.
But I had
listened to a large amount of the interviews in their own respects of when they came out. So it was interesting to see those breakdowns of how you provided narrative out of them. And I think the one that, I mean, that obviously has the, I would say, the most empathy in it is just the healing and the last part of it.
Yeah.
Or maybe not the most empathy, but the more kind of the way that you just described the kind of trajectory of the podcast of coming from, starting from way up here and coming down to like the core center.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there that the very end of that episode was that conversation between your two friends and you and him describing his experience, letting a friend go in the hospital and that very traumatic experience. And I remember when that episode came out and I didn't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
I remember listening to it forever ago. Yeah. And I was like, wow, that was a really beautiful conversation. And I don't know what to do. Yeah. But I appreciate that the conversation was had, even though I had no way to deduct it. But after some time, after about a year, and then it comes up again, and you played it in basically its entirety. The whole discussion about decay and people's relationship to hope struck me really intensely. And I had messaged you like right after I listened to a final episode. Cause I was just like, I don't really know what to say right now, but I finished it and I have so many things happening in my heart and mind. But at that time that I was listening to it, I was getting ready to put my dog down essentially like the next day.
Yeah.
I was thinking that was going to happen. It didn't. I had just left the hospital and I was finishing listening to that on my drive back and finished listening to it while I was chain smoking outside. There's something really, I think this all kind of ties into this kind of forced dissociation and forced colonization of our bodies and our minds. And a major part of that, I feel, results in a lack of understanding that we are living in decay, like the act of decay.
Yeah.
Whether that be ecologically in different biospheres that exist around us and globally, or even our own bodies and our own minds due to capitalism and different systems of oppression that exist. Or a global pandemic where our bodies are at risk at all times.
Yeah.
And something that really just, it maybe even now, I, not that I have a hard time conceptualizing it. I think it's like when an emotion is really deep and you know it's really deep, so you only allow some of it to come up and not all of it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But this kind of acceptance of hopelessness that they were getting at. And yeah. I had never heard somebody talk about it that way.
Yeah.
And it really took me somewhere that I didn't know that I kind of needed to hear. So I'm wondering how, and I phrase this question purposefully, like, how do you confront hope? And I say that in a way, I mean, it's going to come across pessimistic, and I'm not going to argue with that. But I think hope for people who are in this line of work, and I'll include myself in that, or people that are in healing processes, or whether that be like in a decolonized setting or just, you know, in therapy or whatever, hope is a really tricky thing. And I can speak personally because I've talked about it on my show a lot of just, mm-hmm. you know, being a diasporic person, being adopted as a baby and placed into different living experiences and violence and things like that. Hope is such a weird fucking thing to think about. And there's a strong displacement between you and hope. And even in lines of this work of climate crisis and collapse, like, hope is a really dangerous thing, I feel, sometimes, because it doesn't allow you to sit with the emotions of reality.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to stop rambling and ask the actual question.
That's good.
How do you embrace or confront hope in your work and how you have a lens to see the world?
Yeah. Sometimes I feel like it's a matter of scale. So, for instance, like, I'm in a really loving relationship right now, and I have a lot of hope in my relationship with my partner. And I have a lot of really good, loving people in my life, and I have a lot of hope for them and whatever they do. I think hope can easily reside there. But when I start getting into questions around these other subjects that are far bigger than anything I could ever affect on a really big level, on a you know, actual level that is meaningful, what hope, you know, what use is it? And I don't mean that in a utilitarian way as much as I mean, what are we hoping in exactly? Like, what is the hope? What exactly are we expecting to happen?
Yeah.
And that's, to me, the big question I guess I have is, with anyone that's doing activism around this, and I commend them for putting their hearts into it. But if you're going into it thinking that a psychopathic system is going to produce results that are going to somehow mitigate this, then I think you're placing your hope in something that is not going to live up to your desires or expectations.
Yeah.
Some people, though, have a really vague sense of hope. They think that somehow the ingenuity of the human species and human beings will produce a certain result, that this can be avoided. I don't want to rob people of that, if that allows them to live fully. But for me, I feel like it inhibits my ability to be present. Because, like you said, I mean, if we're going to look at the reality of the situation, there's a lot of feelings that come up, and a lot of those feelings are not tied to hope at all.
Yeah,
I feel like hope can be a form of denial in many ways, because it doesn't seem like it leads to anything that's going to produce acceptance or allow us to love more fully, even.
Speak to that a little bit more, because I think that's a really important, that's really what I feel that they were hitting on.
Yeah, I think in that interview you mentioned, that's with Dar Jamil and Barbara Cecil, and
yeah.
Barbara was speaking more to there's something on the other side of hope, or something on the other side of despair, I think is how she said it.
Yeah.
And I think we despair because we have hope that is unrealized.
Mm.
So what she's saying is, like, when you get beyond that, then you're able to navigate a space that's actually quite liberating.
Mm.
Because then you start to ask questions and explore aspects of yourself even that otherwise wouldn't have been able to be addressed because you were holding on to something that will never be realized. And it, when it comes to this massive collapse type situation we're all living through, you know, what are we expecting to happen?
Yeah.
And how can we, I'm sorry, this is really hard to navigate myself.
No, you're okay.
Because I am sometimes very much filled with despair and grief. And so to me, I guess, yeah, it's really hard. I'm sorry. I'm trying to navigate.
Don't apologize, because this is inherently a very intense thing to come to terms with. I think that you had mentioned way earlier that you yourself have troubles processing grief, and I do too.
Yeah.
It's not something that we as a society give ourselves tools for. Like, we aren't given tools of grief.
Yeah.
And I think that is both a Western adoption of, not adoption, it's a configuration of just avoidance of emotion.
Yeah.
And I wonder why. It's probably because you can't have emotion when you're trying to colonize things. But it, grief is really difficult. And there's an author who I think I have mentioned him in possibly every single episode of this show, but his name is Hanif Abdurraqib, and he, is a culture and music writer, but he has a absolutely profound way of describing grief and the human experience, and being that his fullness and his ability to love relies on his ability to grieve or be in the state of potential grieving at all times.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that, boy, would I love to talk to him and figure out how you exist in that space without going fucking insane. But, it's finding this really just all goes full circle of I think that holding grief means to also be really firm in your body and being able to perpetually hold grief, because it's not like it's going to end. That cycle of grief kind of never ends. But there has to be some kind of perpetual grounding that's happening in your body to be able to do that.
Yeah, that's very hard to do. And I'm not very good at it. And that's why I have a reoccurring problem with that, where I don't know how to process whatever it is I'm experiencing. And I think all of us somatically are experiencing, but the culture is going through something, and we're individually experiencing it. And I think, I guess hope to me feels like a false promise, and it seems like it can get in the way of actually really being present with what is happening. And if what is happening doesn't lead to, what is happening is as tragic as it is. I don't know if hope has a place in that. I think it can get in the way. That's this is a very difficult subject to navigate for me, even though I've talked about it a million times. It's still something I don't know how to talk about.
It's really hard. A way that something that I currently am trying to deconstruct for myself in just the way that I think about hope is that hope is commonly referred to in religious circles. And I think to bring it back to what we started talking with, it's this apocalyptic understanding of the world in a religious understanding or a religious lens. And I think that even if it wasn't gruesome, you know, revelations, apocalypse, it's still a kind of apocalypse, a kind of, it is some kind of reckoning, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, and the hope that lives there is that I hope that all of this hell was worth it and I'm going to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
And that's so, that's the kind of distraction hope, right? That you're referring to. And hope being a distraction because that hope is rooted in a false, you know, there are some people that practice religion. I don't want to like steamroll over them, but like that is hope in a reality that is not here, that is not rooted in your body, that is not rooted in the reality that you tangibly live in.
Yeah.
And so, that level of despair that Barbara, right, is her name?
Yeah, Barbara.
That she expounded upon is that, to me, is that kind of letting go of the false reality hope. I'll call it like a lowercase hope, I guess.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this greater hope has to be in, like, what else, literally, what else are you going to put fucking hope in? But you're this interpersonality with the people that are around you, into yourself, into, you know, the earth that you are connected to. That's like the only hope that exists there. And it's not a hope to get to something. It's a hope, I guess, that you can stay connected, or that it's a strive for connection.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I would say find hope in what you know, what you love when it's close to you, you know.
I just want to thank Patrick again for being a guest on the show. I said it at the top of the show. I said it in the middle of the show, so I might as well close it out on this episode of just saying that I really could not suggest Patrick's work more to those who are trying to make sense of current events, trying to make sense of different systems that you may find yourselves of or find yourself in privilege of. It really helps gain the substantial knowledge to look at all of these moving parts and make decisions for yourself in the ways that you can change your actions to call out these injustices or find ways to connect with people on a better way, in a better empathetic way. That is kind of our only hope, is to maintain and hold in reverence and gentleness these relationships that are going to take us to the end, you know. And I really thank Patrick for that, and I thank him for the vulnerability in that conversation. A lot of the times these subjects can get really overwhelming. I know for myself they also get overwhelming. That's why I take breaks, and I am relinquishing guilt or shame that comes with taking breaks because it is very heavy. Anyways, thank you so much, Patrick. If you would like to be connected to his work, all of that information is in the show notes. If you would like to support my work or Patrick's financially, all of that information is there as well. I will catch you guys next week. Thank you so much for listening.